it's Bruce and Connie here from Unlocking the Magic. We just found out some really sad news late last night, early this morning, about Marty Sklar's passing. It was very, very sudden, and we're very, very crushed.
Yeah, I came downstairs today, and I didn't hear about it last night, but I heard about it this morning, and I just immediately sat down and felt extremely sad. Just saw him at D23. And he looked so happy, and his stories were so... He memorized his stories. Like, he could tell you the stories of what 50 years ago, like they just happened yesterday.
Yeah, they were so vibrant.
And he's such a great storyteller, and he had a great perspective on the company and what he's done there. So, I mean, I just wanted to kind of go back and recap our interview with him and reshare his story, because I really want to get it out to as many people as possible.
Reshare. If you guys can share this episode, it would be super, super special. Not for us at Unlocking the Magic, but for Marty and what he's done throughout his lifetime. It's really important for us to... It's up to us to be able to share these stories so that our generation, the young generation behind us, will grow up with these kind of stories.
Yeah, I mean, Marty worked hand in hand with Walt. And he had a great message to share, and we want to be able to help spread that message about, you know, what the company stands for. And Marty was such an integral part of building that company, and everything that he did there was so legendary that, you know, it's important to get that out there, and especially in his books. Like, he did a great job of writing those books. Those books are very entertaining and educational. And if you haven't had a chance to read those yet, I definitely suggest that you go pick them up.
He was one of the few people that was fortunate enough to attend all Disney park openings in the world from 1955, from the original Disneyland. I mean, you could just see and feel the true passion that he had for everything he did.
And even though he technically retired a long time ago, still involved in the Disney community and going to talks and meetings. I mean, he still had things coming out in the future. Like, he had scheduled invitation dinners, and he was writing a new book. He's still such a lively guy that it's all of a sudden to have this happen is just shocking.
Bob Iger said it perfectly just recently. Everything about Marty was legendary. His achievements, his spirit, and his career. He embodied the very best of Disney, from his bold originality to his joyful optimism and relentless drive for excellence. He was also a powerful connection to Walt himself. No one was more passionate about Disney than Marty, and will miss his enthusiasm, his grace, and his spirit.
That was pretty well said.
Very, very humbling.
So let's just, here's our interview with Disney Imagineer and Disney legend, Marty Sklar.
But we have today with us someone very special, someone that we have admired for many, many years. He is the original Imagineer. He's the author of Dream It, Do It, My Half Century, Creating Disney's Magic Kingdoms, and most recently, and maybe my most favorite, newest book, One Little Spark, Mickey's Ten Commandments and the Road to Imagineering. You guessed it, Marty Sklar.
Marty, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us. We are big fans. I bought your first book, Dream It, Do It, at the Writer's Stop at Hollywood Studios many years ago, and I think I read the whole book while we were on vacation, because I started to read it and I couldn't put it down. It was just a really great book. And then when we got your second book, One Little Spark, it really encompasses the philosophy that we try to have with our kids, which is try to find what you like to do. And I love the part in the book where you talked or through emails and letters with all the Imagineers about, you know, their tips and ideas, because they get asked all the time about how to become an Imagineer and what they would do if they could kind of do it all over again. I love that part of the book.
Yeah, thank you. That was important to me, that the book not be just about me, but rather about how so many different Imagineers have taken so many different paths to get where they are, because there's no formula. There's no one way. And young people can't look for that one way, because a lot of things are individual to the person that is doing it and the talents of that person. So it was important to get all those perspectives, I think.
Yeah, it was great to read their different perspectives. And it's great to read because as a parent, we tend to push our kids in a certain direction, even though that may be what we want, but not what they want. And it's important for the kids to kind of find out what they like to do on their own.
Well, one nice part about the book that I've enjoyed, I've heard from four or five different schools that they're using it as a text, and including a couple of college courses. So I think it did what it was intended to do.
Yeah,
it was a really, very, I couldn't put the book down. And actually, after I got finished reading with it, Bruce read it, and now our 14-year-old has picked it up, and she's reading it. So it really is a special book that you can share with all with the whole family, which I really love.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
So for anybody who hasn't heard your backstory, can you bring us back to the first day when you're in college and the Walt Disney Company calls you and says, hey, we want to have you interview for a job? That must have been a scary part for your career.
Well, it was kind of confusing in one sense, because I was living at my fraternity while I went to UCLA, and I wasn't there when the call came in from a Carb Walker. And a message was left for me, and I thought one of my fraternity brothers was playing a joke on me, because he was his father at the time was one of the people who ran the Desert Inn in Las Vegas, and the only part I could think of was had to do with somebody dealing cards in Vegas or something. So I didn't even answer the returned the call. Fortunately, Mr. Walker called me back, and it turned out to be E. Carden Walker, who was then the head of marketing for the studio and movies and the beginnings of Disneyland. And he asked me to come in for an interview, which I did, and they hired me summer after my junior year, and I went to work at Disneyland a month before Disneyland opened.
That's amazing. Were you nervous in your interview? What was the interview process like? Did you meet Walt Disney in the interview or after you already started working there?
No, I met Carb Walker and one of his associates called, his name was Jimmy Johnson, and he ran the record company. They were the ones that interviewed me, and the good news, I guess, was that Card was a UCLA graduate, so that was part of the reason that when they went looking for somebody to do this job, which the whole idea was to have a tabloid newspaper that Walt wanted to do on Main Street at Disneyland the first summer. And I had I was about to be the editor of the Daily Bruin newspaper, student newspaper at UCLA. So I guess I had the right formula. And subsequently, somebody in the archive sent me a memo that Ed Ettinger, who became my first boss at Disneyland, sent to Walt about having found someone to edit this newspaper. And it's a very short memo, but it's kind of interesting. It goes back to June of 1955.
And what was, so the newspaper that you were writing for Disneyland, what was the stories involved? How did you come up with those stories?
Well, Walt wanted to, kind of like the windows on Main Street, you know, he wanted to thank so many people for having helped him accomplish what he wanted to do with Disneyland. So the newspaper was really, it was about, I think it was 28 or 32 pages, and it was really the story of Disneyland and a tribute to a lot of the people that had helped him make Disneyland possible. And my favorite piece was I got one of the, I can't think of his name at the moment, but he was a writer at the studio, wonderful writer, and he wrote a column called Under the Gaslight. Yeah, he was a publicity writer who was at retirement age, actually. Oh, now I remember his name. His name was Jack Youngmeyer, with a J, J-U-N-G Meyer, Youngmeyer. And he was really a good writer, and he wrote a column called Under the Gaslights, which was about having come down to Disneyland and seen Walt wandering all by himself, and the nostalgia of Walt having created this place that meant so much to him, and reminded, in some sense, of, like, for example, Main Street, reminded him so much of his boyhood home in Marceline, Missouri. So, I was fortunate in having access to some of the really good writers at the studio who helped me with the newspaper. And there was a lot of material that had been written, of course, for publicity purposes that I had access to. And so, you know, it's pretty heady stuff for me. I was 21 years old at the time. And actually, I started in mid-June of 1955, a month before Disneyland opened. And 2 weeks after I went to work, I had to present the concept for this newspaper to the Walt Disney.
Wow.
And as you can imagine, I'm 21 years old, never worked professionally. And I was scared as hell. I really was. I've reflected on that many times subsequently in, you know, all the years that have passed. And I realize now that was probably the turning point in my career, the first thing I ever did professionally, because if Walt didn't like what I had presented, they would have gotten one of the pros at the studio to do this newspaper. But he really liked what I had presented, so I got to stay. I got to stay for 50-some years.
Wow. Do you remember what you presented to Walt Disney, like what the concept was?
Oh, sure. It was a tabloid newspaper, and one of the things that I had the good fortune of at UCLA, I knew we used a printer who knew about a type house in Hollywood that had all the old-fashioned wood block types like they used to use around the turn of the century. So I was able to go to that type house and actually use some of those old, authentic woodblock types that they used to use in newspapers around the turn of the century.
Oh, wow.
The turn of the 20th century. So it had an authentic look. And then one thing that was interesting was there was a shop on Main Street. It's where the hat shop is in Town Square now. And it was where the strollers and wheelchairs at that time were rented. And also, you could go in and they had a little printer. And we would leave the headline off the newspaper, and you could get your name printed. And, you know, Bruce and Connie visit Disneyland.
Wow.
And so that was a nice souvenir for people, too.
I wonder if there's any of those left around anywhere.
Gosh, I don't know. I never even had it done for me.
Oh, you didn't?
No.
So,
one thing when you're working on all these things, you don't take the time to do the kinds of things that, except as an example, when we try to roll something out, we do try to experience what the guest is going to receive or experience.
Right. You think of it as the person making it, but you don't really think of the person using it. Like, you wouldn't go there and write your own newspaper, Marty was at Disneyland. That It's just some, not something that you would do, but we would do that as the consumer.
I wish I had done it, though.
I know, huh?
Yeah, it would have been a great souvenir.
How long did you do the new Disneyland newspaper? How long were you on that part of the job?
Well, I only worked the first summer in the PR department at Disneyland, and then I went back to school because I still had my senior year to finish, which I did, and I went to work during my senior year for an advertising trade publication in Los Angeles. I worked maybe 6 or 8 months for them, and then after I graduated, I went back to Disneyland in the fall of '56, and then stayed till I retired in 2009.
Wow. When you were in college, were your college, the people who went to school with you, were they like fascinated with the fact that you worked for Disneyland and, you know, have met Walt Disney? Were they asking you all kinds of questions, and were they like happy?
I was thinking, were you a celebrity?
Yes, that's what I was trying to say.
Well, not so much because Disneyland was brand new then, and a lot of students that I knew had not even been to Disneyland by that time. Mm-hmm. And so if it were today, it would be very, very different.
Right.
But at that time, there was not as much knowledge about Disneyland, and yeah, there were a few people that knew that what I'd done and were interested in knowing more, but it wasn't anything like it is today.
Right. And then you transitioned into writing for Walt Disney. What was that like?
Well, that was quite an unusual opportunity because when I came back in the fall of '56, Walt wanted to start communicating about future projects and also about opportunities for sponsors because that sponsorship money was important to create new attractions. So I was, even though I was in the publicity department at Disneyland, I was kind of loaned to WED Enterprises, which was Walt's company that he had formed in 1952 to design Disneyland. And I did three, I guess you'd call them booklets more than brochures. One was called Disneyland USA, and it was the story of Disneyland. It was really aimed at sponsors. And then there were two more. One was called Edison Square, and it was Walt wanted to do a street off Main Street that was based on Thomas Edison and the advent of electricity. And so that brochure was aimed probably more at General Electric than anything. excuse me. Ultimately, that became the story of the Carousel Progress for the New York World's Fair. But at the time, it was thought of as a walk-through street, kind of like Greenfield Village that Henry Ford had done in Dearborn, Michigan. And then the other was about Liberty Square, and Walt wanted to do another street off Main Street based on the advent of the country and the Constitution. And, of course, that became Liberty Square in the Magic Kingdom at Walt Disney World, ultimately. Mm-hmm. But that put me in touch working with all the great people at WED, and it was the first time I worked with Dick Irvine, who ran the design company, and Bill Cottrell, who was the president of WED, John Hand, Herb Ryman, and Claude Coates, and all those great people that became my colleagues later. But it was the first time I had worked with them.
It's amazing to us to hear you mention those names because they're, you know, Disney legends, and you hear about those people and you worked with them. For us, it's, you know, it's legend, but for you, it's, you know, what you did for so many years.
Well, you know, it was a lesson that I never forgot. That here I was, I was 22, 23 years old. And as long as Walt or Dick Irvine put me on a project, they accepted me as though I'd been there 30 years. And because they just said, well, if Walt put Marty here, he must know what he's doing.
Right.
Right. So I never forgot that, because I think it carried over in my whole career in leadership at Imagineering, particularly during the Epcot project, where we had so many young people really doing something for the first time and taking a chance that they could accomplish what we needed them to do. And I think a lot of that came from the acceptance that I had from the John Henches and the Herb Rymans and Claude Coates and Mark Davis and Lane Gibson and so many more.
That's amazing. It's amazing to hear you say those names. Now, Walt Disney had a knack for putting people in the right spot, even if they maybe didn't think they were a good fit there. What made him so good at that? Do you have an answer for that?
Well, I think Walt was willing to take a chance on people as well as projects. And he knew his talent. I mean, I always said that Claude Coates and Mark Davis would never go to lunch with each other, but when you put them together on to do Pirates of the Caribbean, it was magic, you know?
Yeah.
Because Claude's skills were things like laying out a ride and determining where the different characters should go. And then Mark's skill was doing all the gags and the humor and the wonderful characters that he created. And so when you mix those two things together, it was really terrific, because you were putting two of the best ever talents together to do something. Yet they were not friends. They were not close to each other. And it didn't matter, you know, because they didn't have to go to lunch with each other to do the kind of thing that Walt needed from them.
That's awesome. Now, you go ahead, Connie.
I was wondering what it's like reflecting now, Marty. What is it like for you when you visit the parks now? Can you go into the parks now, sort of incognito, or is it really hard for you to visit as a guest?
It's probably easier now than when my kids were young, because when my son Howard and my daughter Leslie, whenever. Young, after a while, they didn't want to go to the parks with me, and I couldn't figure out why, and it wasn't until much later when they were well grown up that they told me, and they said, you know what, we walk down Main Street with you, and you pick up trash, and if somebody is taking a picture with their family, you stop and say, could I take that picture for you, et cetera. They said, well, it would take us a half an hour to get down Main Street. So we didn't have any of the fun that,
that all the other guests were enjoying. You were working.
it was part of your life at that point. Like, that was just what you did. It wasn't the second thought for you.
Well, sure, because, you know, it's hard when you create these things. It's hard to go and not look for the things that are not being operated the way you'd like to see them, or something that wasn't properly maintained, or whatever it is, something that's out of sync in narration or something like that. And those are the things that you're more aware of than any of the guests are. The guests might not even notice any of those things. And yet, that's what we're trained, that's what we did, and we know how something is supposed to run, and if it isn't being run that way, and by the way, the parks do a great job. They really do.
Yeah.
some of the shows that I've written about, like my favorite maintenance job is in Epcot on the American Adventure. They've done such a spectacular job of keeping that show pristine and running just the way it was when we left it originally, and they're so proud of it. And so that kind of dynamic between the designers and the operators is really a key to so much of why the Disney park works so well for our guests.
It is truly amazing. Now let me ask you, I'm curious about this one myself, because I know how hard writing is. And when you write for a man like Walt Disney, who is known for being a perfectionist, was it hard to write his speeches and the things that he was going to talk about? And how long, I'm curious about how long that process took and how many times you went back and forth and where it began. So much information that I would love to know about that.
Well, as far as I know, Walt only made one real speech, and I didn't write it. It was to the Theater Owners of America. What I wrote for some television things and the film about Walt Disney World and Epcot, and I did Walt's messages for the annual report for about 4 years, company's annual report, and then all the souvenir guides and special things we did to market the parks that I used to do. You know, and it started out where I would either meet with him and get a sense of what he wanted to do, or send him a note suggesting some things. But after a while, he trusted me enough so that, for example, on the annual reports, Bobby Moore, who was the art director at the studio for marketing things, and I would sit down with Roy Disney, because the annual report was almost all a financial report. We turned it into a marketing job with the messages from Walt and Roy and a lot of publicity kind of things. So we'd sit down with Roy and then come up with a theme for the annual report, and then I would write Walt's piece after a while without even talking to him, and then send it to him. So that kind of trust was really important over time, and something that I really valued quite a bit, that he trusted me to be able to do this without even sitting down with him. And then I get notes back, of course, and things he wanted to emphasize or change or whatever it was.
Much different than now, because it was really notes. It wasn't emails or text messages or anything like that.
Oh, no. You know, you'd have to write a memo and have a secretary type it, and, my God, the carbon paper. It's a different world, I'll tell you.
Now, I wonder if Walt could have envisioned what Disney World and Disneyland and the Disney Company as a whole has come to be now, because he always had... You know, he was always looking to the future, but he was really a nostalgic type of person as well. Do you think that he envisioned what it is now? Is that something that he could have foreseen in the future for the Walt Disney Company when he was alive?
Well, I don't think he'd be very much surprised. In fact, I was asked numerous times while I was working, what would Walt think, you know, and I never answered that question. Until we finally did, when we did Hong Kong Disneyland, and somebody asked me the question in Cantonese, and so it was being interpreted. I had a little time to think about it, and finally they said, what would Walt think? And I said, well, Walt would say, what took you so long?
Oh, that's too funny.
That's hilarious.
Because, you know, he was impatient, but I remember... For the presentation that I wrote for him, when Walt and Roy announced with Governor Burns announced the Walt Disney World Project in 1965, we did a search and got the way his foreign television was done. So, in other words, we used a lot of French and Japanese, Walt being Walt talking on those television shows that had, at the time, they were not, they were all done with a voiceover that was supposed to be Walt's voice. And so we had 22 different languages, and this was 1965. So,
wow.
Disney was worldwide then already. So it was only a matter of time before the parks also became worldwide. So that really, I don't think it would have surprised Walt at all that the worldwide impact of what he had started.
Yeah, he was really a great entrepreneur, even in today's standards.
So back to your book, reading the book, it's really super interesting. It's almost as if you read my mind when we received the book. It unlocked a lot of the attractions that you had hands-on experience with, and some flops that you shared, which I thought was really interesting to see that kind of insight. But what I was curious, what was your favorite attraction that you worked on? Do you have one?
Oh boy!
Sorry.
It's like saying your favorite child.
Right, exactly. I just realized it as I said it out loud that that's going to be a really tough question to answer.
Well, I've been asked many times about my favorite park, and of course Disneyland is that, because it's the only one that Walt ever walked in, number one. Number two, it was the foundation for everything that was done subsequently around the world, 12 parks in total now with Shanghai, which is, by the way, is a fabulous park, really wonderful to take advantage of everything Disney's done in the parks over time. And the Pirates attraction is really unbelievable. It's really fantastic. But, of course, I have a hard time saying Epcot was my favorite project, because we spent 8 years from the time we started to the time we opened, and there was no precedent for it, because all the other parks were fantasy-based, and here was a park that was reality-based, if you will.
Right.
As someone had said, the other parks, fantasy real, and Epcot makes reality fantasy in many ways. Epcot is pretty close to my favorite. And one of my favorite attractions is the Land Pavilion in Epcot, because it has a story that's important to tell about food production around the world, and then you go into this area where you're actually seeing the food growing, and then to take it another step, you can go into the restaurant in the land and eat the food that we're growing.
Yeah.
There. That, to me, that is it's a demonstration of what Walt really wanted to accomplish with the whole community of that.
I'm so excited that you mentioned the Land Pavilion, because that is our ultimate favorite in Epcot.
Oh, yeah, that's mine.
I get overwhelmed looking around at all the different vegetables and fruits that they grow and how they grow. It's amazing to see all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. I think back to we did a quarter-scale demonstration of that the University of Arizona, where Dr. Carl Hodges was really the one that helped us create that growing area. And we walked through about a quarter of the whole ride laid out. And when we were finished, Carl Hodges said to me, he said, "Now, where do we keep the bees?" And I said, "Carl, we're in an open boat, no bees." And he said, "Well, how are we gonna pollinate the food?" I said, "You know something, Carl? We're story people here. You're the technologist. You're going to tell me how you're going to pollinate the food."
Exactly.
That's funny. You never really think about that while you're riding the attraction.
Well, they have to hand pollinate all of that.
Yeah.
And about, I think it's about once or twice a week, they have to go through and pollinate all that food so it keeps growing.
Wow. That's awesome. That's incredible. And we love taking the kids on that attraction. And one thing that we love about all the parks is that we feel that the kids are enjoying themselves, they're being entertained, but they're also learning something. And it makes it really special. It's a way for us to connect as a family, and that's one of the reasons why we love going to Disney World often, and that Land Pavilion is a must-do every time.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think it's very, very special. And, you know, one of the things that you can trace with so many different attractions, not just in Epcot, but in Epcot particularly, is that learning can be fun.
Yeah.
And we can make it fun. You can be serious about certain things, tell serious stories. The American Adventure is a wonderful example of that. And yet at the same time, it's entertainment, it's fun, and it's an experience like the ride through in the land is a experience that you can't have anywhere else. And I think those are the kinds of things that Disney is so good at doing.
Yeah. And we talk about that on the show a lot. Just, you know, many times people go to Disney World and or Disneyland or any of the parks, and they try to do as much as they possibly can. And we always say, you know what, take a step back, relax a little bit, slow down, and take a look around, because there's so many more messages that you'll find if you do that way than trying to just go from attraction to attraction.
Yeah, I learned something early on at Walt Disney World. I think it was the first time I took both my kids and their families, and I had a whole schedule set up, and the third day at dinner the night before, the end of the second day, I said to everybody, "Now, tomorrow, here's what our schedule is." And my son said to me, "Tomorrow, we're sitting by the pool."
Oh, that's so funny.
That sounds like Connie.
Here's the thing. If you go to Walt Disney World and you say, "I'm going to try to do everything here," you're going crazy.
Yeah, there's so much to do.
You can't do it. You've got to pick and choose and say, "Okay, this trip I'm going to do such and such and such and such, and the next trip I'll save for doing this and that." And you'll have a much better time if you schedule yourself that way.
Right. We're actually making our first trip to Disneyland. We've been to Disney World many, many, many times, but we're making our first trip to Disneyland in 2 weeks.
Oh, well, congratulations.
Thank you.
We're very, very excited.
Yeah, we're in Boston, so we're kind of far away from the Los Angeles, California area, but we're making the trek out there. It's going to be our first trip. The kids are really excited to, like you said, walk the park that Walt Disney actually saw and walked in.
Yeah, you'll find Disneyland is it's a much more, I don't want to say, it's much, things are much closer together. The big spaces, the things that we did at Walt Disney World and later, where you realize how many people you had to handle. In those early days, the Imagineers really didn't have the experience to know if that they were going to get 15 million people a year coming through this place.
Right.
So things are a lot closer together, and there's some nice little off-the-beaten-path places that you can go at Disneyland, and it's a really nice feeling.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I'm a very nostalgic person myself, so just being able to be at the exact park where, you know, it all started is just a true honor, and such an honor to have you on our show, Marty. I can't thank you enough.
And we're definitely going to spread the word about your book, One Little Spark, Mickey's Ten Commandments and the Road to Imagineering. It's a really great book for you, your family, everybody in your family. It's a great read. I highly recommend it.
Well, thank you. It's been fun talking to you.
Thank you so much, Marty. We really appreciate you taking your time out of your day. It's really an honor for us to have you and talk to you. It's
maybe I was nervous in the beginning, but like you said, it's just a talk between three. I feel like we're friends now. And
see, you can be very relaxed on the telephone.
Right. Much more nervous in person, definitely.
I was just going to say, although it'd be incredible to meet someday in person.
Well, thank you very much. I'd like to do that.
All right, thank you, Marty, so much for joining us. I hope you have a great day.
Okay, you guys too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.